many thanks for the financial support that Current State listeners have pledged in recent days to our program. You know who you are, and it is much appreciated. And everybody here at Current State promises to make the most of it here during the rest of 2014. Half of the dollars WKAR needs to pay for Current State, this program, morning edition, classical music, all of it. It really, half of it comes from you, our listeners. We are cognizant of that fact, and we are very grateful. Thanks again. At the top of our program here for Tuesday, April 1st, Social Entrepreneurship, where for-profit businesses seek to offer creative solutions to our society's biggest needs, has become a rising trend across the country. And last year, Detroit was home to the nation's first social entrepreneurship competition, which attracted more than $1 million in new investment for a diverse group of new businesses that focus on such issues as energy efficiency, affordable medical devices, and coffee roasting. The competition was put on by Michigan Core, with the help of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, and it was such a success that they're holding a second social entrepreneurship challenge and have recently begun taking submissions. With us now to tell us more, Elizabeth Garlow. Elizabeth is the Executive Director of Michigan Core. Good to see you.
Pleasure to be here, Mark.
And joining us by phone is Amy Peterson, the co-founder of Rebel Nell, which is a jewelry company that was one of the winners in last year's competition. Amy, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
It's great to have you, Elizabeth. This is the second year of the Social Entrepreneurship Challenge. Tell us the basics about how it works.
I'd love to. So the Social Entrepreneurship Challenge began, as you mentioned, Mark, last year, because our organization, Michigan Core, together with the governor and the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, understood that our communities around Michigan faced a number of challenges ranging from unemployment to blight in our communities, and we knew that there had to be a number of different ideas people had at a grassroots level to solve these problems. We saw that there were many entrepreneurs that were, starting companies that could have a positive impact in the community, and so we wanted to launch a competition to see what sort of ideas were out there, how we could nourish those ideas and support them. So we put a call out to the community, and we were shocked. We had over 300 ideas submitted to this competition, selected 10 winners, worked with those individuals to help develop their ideas, and those individuals have now secured, as you mentioned, over $1 million in new investment to scale their work.
And Amy, your jewelry company, Rebel Nell, was one of the winners last year. Tell us about Rebel Nell.
Oh, I'd be happy to. And it was such an honor to be part of that program. I think it really helped launch our business. At Rebel Nell, we create jewelry from a unique local resource. We use graffiti. And the whole reason that our business exists is to provide a transitional opportunity for underserved women in the community. We employ them, educate them, and empower them through understanding of how to run a small business, encouraging them to become entrepreneurs someday.
And how exactly do you use graffiti to create jewelry?
It sounds like a crazy concept, but what happens is, in many places around the city, paint will accumulate after several artists will continue to, quote, tag these particular areas. And after so many tags, the paint layers become heavy or damaged caused from Mother Nature, and they'll start to flake off, and we'll find them laying on the ground. And so we will collect those pieces, and through our process, we're able to reveal all the different layers of paint, and it creates a very kaleidoscopic look. It's very psychedelic, and all these beautiful colors come out. And the unique part about our business is that we allow the women to really design all of the beautiful pendants that we make, and we've seen that help restore their confidence as they continue to have creative control over the pieces that they make.
And have you managed to add many people to the payroll at Rebel Nell? Are you growing the number of people who work for you?
Yes. In fact, we were just going to start with one, and through the help of Michigan Core and through the whole learning experience that we were able to benefit from, we were able to take on 3 women and hope to take on another 2 by the end of the year.
How interesting. Elizabeth, tell us about some of the bigger takeaways for your organization after last year's competition? What'd you learn that really resonated?
Well, I think there are two things in particular. One is that there are just Michiganders that are coming out in droves with ideas to benefit the community, whether that be working with at-risk youth in the community, or as Amy is doing with Rebel Nell, providing job opportunities for those who have been long-term unemployed. And for us, it's been inspiring to see just how many people have credible ideas to solve these problems and have been really hungry for a space to share those ideas. The other thing that's really surprised us, I think, is the number of individuals and funds who are interested in investing in these types of concepts. And we're talking about investors that are coming together around shared values and a shared vision for the community, who are willing to put their capital into these types of businesses, perhaps secure a below market rate return, but they do expect that their investment will be returned to them, but they also expect a social impact return. So they're looking for what we would call kind of a blended value return. And we've been really inspired by a community of investors, both inside and outside the state, who want to invest in that type of entrepreneurship.
Amy, how would you explain, from your perspective, how do you explain this change in thinking that Elizabeth just referred to, this blended approach? When you think of why you started Rebel Nell, and when you from your experience with other like-minded social entrepreneurs like yourself, where is this change coming from?
I think it has a lot to do with the community in which we live right now. I can speak especially for living in downtown Detroit. There's a lot of passionate people and a lot of people who want to help change the environment in downtown and offer services where they seem to not exist. And that I can speak for myself, and where I live is very close to one of the shelters, and so I would often speak to these women, and heard a very similar theme throughout all these conversations. You know, these were hardworking women who fell upon really difficult situations, many coming from abusive relationships, and they just needed someone to believe in them. And the whole reason that Rebel Nell started was to provide this type of transitional opportunity. The jewelry was just a way to help the business, but I really wanted to start a business with that goal in mind. And I wanted it to be sustainable, so we won't have to always rely on grant money, and that's the change between, you know, starting a nonprofit versus starting. We're structured as an L3C, which is a limited low-profit liability company, which I'm glad that Michigan recognizes now.
Your business started with the impulse to give back, and you weren't really sure what kind of shape the business would take. But that all changed, as I recall, when you were on a jog one day. Tell our listeners about what happened on that jog and what you saw.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. My business partner and I knew we wanted a jewelry business. We both had a background in jewelry, and we knew we wanted it to be Detroit-centric jewelry, but we didn't have an idea yet. And so I was out jogging one day on our beautiful DeQuinder Cut, and if many of the listeners who know Detroit, that's very heavily covered in graffiti, beautiful graffiti, and I noticed that a piece had fallen on the ground. And I thought just on its surface it was pretty unique, and I brought it home. And then as I turned it on its side, I could see that it was made up of multiple layers of paint, and I just started experimenting to see if there was a way that I could expose those layers and figure out if I could tell kind of the history of the graffiti through a piece of jewelry. And that's, it worked, needless to say, and we've been rolling with that idea ever since.
Elizabeth Garlow, the response to the challenge, the social entrepreneurship challenge, was a lot more than you expected the first year. Can you gauge what kind of response you're going to be getting the second time around?
Well, we're certainly all wondering that at this moment because we're midway through the registration period, and so we do have really we're continuing to accept applications to the competition and through April 30th. But one thing that's really unique about this year's competition and why we think we'll see another huge surge in interest is that we've brought on a number of different partners. So we this year have 10 new sponsoring organizations that have sponsored various prize tracks that consist of cash prizes for entrepreneurs from communities all across Michigan. We also have prizes that are specific to communities like Detroit and Flint. We have business support service prizes. So for example, Jaffe, which is a southeastern Michigan-based law firm, has funded a pro bono legal services package. Consumers Energy funded a prize for an entrepreneur that demonstrates collaboration with the corporate community. So we have a wide variety of awards and prize tracks that we think will draw significant interest and hopefully help us surface a number of great ideas and communities all around Michigan.
Amy, since you launched Rebel Nell, tell us more about some of the more pragmatic business lessons that you've learned, the really nuts and bolts kinds of insights that you've had.
I will have to give a tip of the hat to being a part of the Michigan Corps Social Fellows program, and that they really helped us explore, you know, our strengths and weaknesses and really honing in on what could be your weaknesses and seeing those come to light as the process evolved. It was wonderful to have already explored those with the mentors that we had available to us. And it was wonderful one-on-one coaching. But I think that that really helped shape our business and helped put us on a path towards success. So there's been lots of bumps, and you know, with any new business, you're going to find them. But I feel that we were well prepared to handle all of those bumps that came along.
How much more upside is there for the city of Detroit via social entrepreneurship, Elizabeth? Do you feel like there's still a lot of up? I mean, I've read about this trend. I think a lot of people who live here have read about this trend of the last few years. Is there still a lot of unrealized potential to social entrepreneurship in Detroit?
Oh, absolutely. I think we're at the tip of the iceberg. And in fact, we are now hearing from cities and states across the country who are reaching out to us about what we did with this model last year. I think a lot of eyes are on Detroit and Flint and Lansing and all of our communities because we are facing some pretty tough challenges, and we do have to think of new ways to solve them and to solve them at the scale they need to be solved at, right? And so I think this sort of grassroots network of entrepreneurs is an untapped strategy in many communities. I think what's interesting for us as we look at and work with the entrepreneurs, Amy mentioned that this fellowship program we run, so every competition finalist goes through a follow-on training fellowship program. And as we work and become more familiar with those individuals and their vision for the community, we understand that those who live and work in these communities have long-term ownership over the vitality of those communities, and so hence have a lot of ideas that I think could be invested in, could be scaled, and we could see a lot of really lasting impact come out of that.
Amy, as a resident of the city, I have to ask you, what do you feel the city of Detroit needs above everything else? If you could change one thing about the state of the city of Detroit in 2014, what would you change?
Oh, that's kind of a loaded question. I believe firmly in the push for social entrepreneurship. I think that that can be a major change, and I think that, you know, we're seeing it not only just from our company and the support we've received and how this community has embraced social entrepreneurship, but if that continues to grow and you can kind of work to employ those that are already in the community and need help, I just think that makes such a stronger community.
So, Elizabeth, one more time for people who, for budding social entrepreneurs who want to get involved, where do they go and what do they need to do by when?
We welcome all aspiring and existing entrepreneurs that have a social impact focus to register with us online. You can go to MichiganCorps.org, so that's Michigan, C-O-R-P-S.org. Click on the challenge, and you'll find all the instructions there to enter this competition by April 30th. You can also give us a call at 313-451-1000. 1217. It's 313-451-1217.
Such an interesting and encouraging trend. We want to thank both of our guests, Elizabeth Garlow, Executive Director of Michigan Corps, and Amy Peterson, co-founder of Rebel Nell, a jewelry company that was one of the winners in last year's inaugural Michigan Social Entrepreneurship Challenge. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, the Michigan State Spartans had a great run through March Madness, falling just short of making the Elite Eight. Routinely, coaches, including MSU's Tom Izzo, play back video of games to sharpen their team's performances. MSU has a lot of tapes like that and other sporting events, some of which predate World War II. But those old film and video clips are falling apart over time. Now, MSU is asking the public for donations to digitize those records for posterity. Current State's Kevin Labrie joins me in the studio with more. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Good. So game tape goes back a few years, then.
It does. MSU really has a treasure trove of literally thousands of these films and videos of sporting events that go back even to the 1930s and other aspects of Spartan life, music, concerts, lots of different educational outreach projects. But as you say, they are in danger of being lost because they're just so old and brittle. I talked with Portia Vesio about this. She is the Assistant Director of University Archives and Historical Collections at MSU. She says some of the most interesting parts of the collection are oral histories, and some of them are quite old.
We have a audio cassette of an oral history interview with Floyd Barden, who was a student who graduated in 1908.
And I'm looking at the date there, September 16th, 1973.
What did you find when you went to college in 1904?
Well, some of the people that had made the college famous still connected with the institution, like Dr. Beale, and I had him as instructor in botany in two different courses at least. And Dr. Frank Kedzie, who was the son of the old Dr. Kedzie, a very efficient teacher of chemistry, and with his characteristics that set him aside with trickery.
We have interviews that were done with people about the Great Depression, interviews with former presidents, John Hanna, Clifton Wharton, Cecil Mackey, and others, all of which are in formats which are obsolete right now and are hard to play, let alone listen to for people wanting to do research. And so what we're trying to do is to reformat these records so that they can be available to people wanting to do research, and also because these formats that they're in are deteriorating slowly over time, and if we don't do something now, it's possible that we may lose that information permanently.
Has a lot of this already been digitized over the years, or are you really starting this project now from the ground up?
We are starting this project now from the ground up. We have done bits and pieces over the years, but this is a new initiative.
How many records are we talking about?
Thousands. I know we have just thousands of rolls of 16 and 8 millimeter film, hundreds of reel-to-reel film, reel-to-reel audio recordings, and I don't even know, like, if you count all the different video formats, Betamax, U-matic, things people don't even remember anymore, and the students these days have never heard of.
I am looking right here at a Betamax tape. Betamax hasn't been around in 30 plus years. And this is something I'm sure most Spartans would want to see, the 1978-79 Spartan NCAA basketball championship season.
Oh, that Reed has hit three.
Oh, there's the pass.
Look at John. Oh,
goal.
It's
goal.
It's all over. Michigan State University, national champions, 1979.
We have a lot of recordings of Spartan sports that go back to the 1930s.
Oh, absolutely. We have football, we have basketball, some hockey, other sports that are available. There's no shortage. There's hundreds of reels of sports film. Marching band, we have hundreds of reels of recordings of Leonard Falcone and the marching band. So even if you're only interested in sports or music, we still will be able to preserve history in that area.
You know, about 5 or 6 years ago, I was actually going through a lot of our records at WKAR, a lot of our reel-to-reel tape, and some of these things were 50 years old, and there is nothing more frustrating than finding a piece of historical tape that you think is really interesting and compelling, and you load it on the machine, and poof, it snaps into a cloud of dust.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely one of the issues that we encounter. The other thing is that a lot of these formats, they were high-tech at the time that they were created, but because technology has changed so quickly, they've become obsolete. So nowadays, very few people have reel-to-reel players. Very few people are able to watch film on a projector. Equipment is becoming harder and harder to find, and if it breaks, we don't have the memory to repair them.
I'm looking here at another box you've got, and this certainly looks very old. This looks like about a dozen metal film canisters from reel to reel.
Exactly. We have some materials that are not MSU related, and this is a good example. These are from the Hackley and Hume collection, which was a lumbering company up in Muskegon, Michigan. But these are actually travel films from the 1930s, and it shows places like London, La Jolla, California, San Diego, Panama, all in the 1930s. And so it's just a great way, if you're interested in history or you're interested in these locations, to see what they looked like at an earlier point in time. Do you smell the vinegar syndrome coming from these?
Oh, yes, I do.
Just give it a minute. That means that the film has already started degrading. Once it starts degrading, there's nothing you can do to stop it, but you can slow it. And if you're able to digitize it before it gets too bad, you can still make this information available to people.
How can people contribute?
We have created a fund that people can contribute to. It is called the MSU Film and Video Preservation Fund, and we have a website that people can go to. If you go to archives.msu.edu, you'll find the link under our giving page.
Portia Vecchio is Assistant Director of University Archives and Historical Collections at Michigan State University. Portia, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
.5 WKAR in Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Last week, as much as 1,600 gallons of oil spilled into Lake Michigan from the BP refinery in Whiting, Indiana, 20 miles from Chicago. After a week-long cleanup, authorities say they found no further trace of spilled oil in the area. However, the political ramifications of the spill are likely to remain long after this incident. The BP refinery processes oil from tar sands found in Canada. Tar sands contain thick petroleum that's gaining popularity as a new energy source. New technology is making it easier to mine tar sands, but some worry that could increase the likelihood of more spills like the one last week. Lyman Welch is the Water Quality Program Director for the Alliance for the Great Lakes. He's also an attorney specializing in environmental law. He's here to talk with us today about the issues around shipping tar sand crude oil on the Great Lakes. Mr. Welch, welcome to Current State.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
The BP refinery in Whiting has only been processing Canadian tar sands a little less than a year now. Were there safety concerns prior to this spill?
There have been concerns generally with our spill response and prevention procedures in the United States and Canada in the Great Lakes. Last year, the Alliance of the Great Lakes released a report that pointed out gaps in our region's methods to prevent oil spills and respond to them. Particularly, our procedures don't do well, and really the Great Lakes are not prepared to respond to heavy oil which can sink to the bottom and be very difficult to remove.
What's the attraction of tar sand crude oil? Why is it getting so much attention these days?
We're seeing much attention from industry because there are large reserves of these heavy, dirtier tar sands oils available in Canada, and the industry is looking to have these tar sands refined into petroleum and other petroleum products in the Midwest. There's an economic demand for more petroleum, and given the cost to extract the tar sands, it's now become very feasible to make a great deal of profit by extracting tar sands and shipping them into the Midwest for refining and shipment elsewhere.
And is tar sand crude relatively abundant then?
There are a great deal of reserves, and we're seeing a great interest in expanding capacity to move the tar sands for refining. Many companies are proposing to expand pipelines, and since the pipeline capacity is not able to handle the demand, industry is looking to move tar sands oils using other methods, such as rail shipment, and they're now also exploring shipment on the Great Lakes by vessel, and that's a risk that we have raised through our report and a real concern to the Great Lakes. Currently, there's no tar sand shipment taking place by vessel on the Great Lakes. And since the Great Lakes provide drinking water and recreation to more than 40 million people in the region, a spill in the Great Lakes of tar sands oil would be devastating.
Is tar sands crude more destructive when spilled than other forms of petroleum?
As we saw in 2010 with a leak from an Enbridge pipeline into the Kalamazoo River in Michigan, the tar sands oils are a much dirtier form of crude, and they're heavier than water. So when a tar sands oil spills into water, it sinks to the bottom, and it is very difficult to remove. After that spill, Enbridge and the company has spent over $1 billion and over 3 years trying to clean up the tar sands oils that were spilled in the Kalamazoo River. And still, nearly 20% of that oil spill remains at the bottom of the river and may never be fully cleaned up.
We're talking with Lyman Welch. Lyman Welch is the Water Quality Program Director for the Alliance for the Great Lakes. We're talking about the fallout from last week's oil spill from a BP refinery in Whiting, Indiana, into Lake Michigan. This particular refinery has weathered some controversy in the past. What's been its environmental and regulatory track record?
Well, the BP Whiting, Indiana refinery is one of the largest refineries on the Great Lakes. And several years ago, when BP proposed expanding its facility to process the tar sands crude oil, there was a great deal of controversy over emissions into the Great Lake and into the air from the new facility. Eventually, BP agreed to limit its discharges of pollutants, including mercury, to what its previous permit has been. But environmental groups and the regulators had to press further on air emissions and pollution from the new facility to get agreements to limit the amount of pollution from that facility. As you know, BP upgraded its processes and refinery to handle these new heavier tar sands oils, it shows us that with this recent spill that even with the most modern and up-to-date facility, there still is a risk of oil spills into Lake Michigan and the Great Lakes of these heavier tar sands oils.
Does BP want to increase the production out of the Whiting facility?
Yes, that was the purpose of the upgrade, was to increase its production and to handle these heavier, dirtier oils and process them at the refinery.
Is BP still sanctioned or fined due to the 2010 Gulf spill? Does that is that relevant here?
Yes, the company as a whole is responsible following the BP spill into the Gulf, and regulators are looking at that. As they are looking at all of BP's operations within the company. So it does bear some impact. But BP faces independently fines and penalties for this spill because oil spills are prohibited under the Clean Water Act and the Oil Pollution Prevention Act requirements here.
And what's next in your view?
There continues to be, increased demand by industry to move tar sands. And the real unanswered question here is how will industry ensure the safety of these shipments as there's more demand to bring tar sands crude oil into the Midwest? Right now, still, the shipment on the Great Lakes of by vessel of tar sands has not been, begun. And it's a real opportunity for the region as a whole, since this affects both the United States and Canada around the Great Lakes, to have a discussion and decide whether it's appropriate for tar sands crude oil to be shipped by vessel on the Great Lakes. For BP, right now it looks like we were pretty lucky with this spill. It was a relatively smaller spill, discovered quickly and happened near the shoreline. And all those factors made it much easier to address this spill from the BP refinery than it would be to address a deep water spill that occurred farther from the coast of the Great Lakes of this tar sands oil that sinks to the bottom. So right now the government officials, EPA and the Coast Guard, are nearly wrapping up their oversight of the spill response by BP. It looks like the spill has been fairly well cleaned up, and now the attention will turn to see that BP provides a full accounting so that we understand the real cause of this spill and what BP will be doing to prevent future spills like this. And, of course, the government agencies will be following through on fines and penalties and to ensure that BP fully accounts for the damage caused by this spill.
Lyman Welch is the Water Quality Program Director for the Alliance of the Great Lakes. We've been talking about shipping tar sands crude oil on the Great Lakes and the recent spill out of BP Whiting in Indiana. Mr. Welch, thank you.
Thank you.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Welcome back to Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. This year, MSU's Abrams Planetarium is celebrating 50 years. And to mark the milestone, the planetarium's original star projector is being reassembled by one of the original staffers. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with John Hare, who worked at Abrams nearly 50 years ago. Emmanuel, tell us more about this project.
Well, it's really cool, mainly because there's this old black and white photo of John working on the old star projector, and they essentially recreated that photo, and I got to kind of see that. John hasn't worked at Abrams for a while. He left for a planetarium, and he eventually founded his own company, which repairs planetarium equipment, so it was really special for him to be back there, and he said it was an absolute pleasure repairing the projector.
I'm in town to reassemble the original optical mechanical star projector that had been gathering dust in the basement of the planetarium since it was taken out of commission back in the early 90s. Well, it was replaced with a full-dome video projector, and even that technology has evolved to the point where the full-dome video projector that is now in service at the planetarium is obsolete by today's standards, and Hopefully within a few years, they'll be able to upgrade the capability to take advantage of the latest high-definition, full-color, full-dome video.
What was the planetarium like in the early days? I always hear about laser shows and that sort of thing. Is that the kind of atmosphere it was? Or?
Well, laser shows are still presented in planetariums. At Abrams Planetarium in the early days, we didn't do any of that. It was just strictly astronomy education. Some of the staff at the planetarium, myself and others, especially some of the student help, kind of started branching out and looking at other ways that the planetarium could be utilized beyond just being a model of the outdoor sky and a classroom for astronomy. And so we started doing light shows at the planetarium, just using strobe lights and kaleidoscope projectors and using things like baby food jars and Pepsi bottles to come up with abstract image projectors. The late 60s and early 70s, this was a time when there was a lot of interest in psychedelic sorts of things. You know, the music reflected that. The drug culture reflected that. And, you know, students would come to the planetarium in altered states to enjoy the the experience that it offered them. It was unique in many respects. You couldn't go to a movie over in East Lansing, or you couldn't go to a performance in the auditorium or anything like that that equaled the, in many cases, abstract experiences that we were able to create in the planetarium. So it kind of evolved into a very popular venue for the counterculture.
What's it like for you to be back here and reassembling that piece of equipment that you used to work with?
Well, it's brought back a lot of memories because one of the things that we did two nights ago, I arrived here and I met John French over at the planetarium, and we went down to the basement and looked at what equipment was still there. He had already moved some of the equipment over to the building that we're in now, where the assembly is being done. But going through the basement of the planetarium, seeing the old offices and old workspaces, and seeing, in some cases, parts bins on the wall with labels that I recognized as my handwriting, and seeing posters for programs that were produced 30, 40 years ago that had my hand in you know, the production, it just was very nostalgic to me, you know, experiencing that in lots of cases. Like, you know, you see something over there and you say, that's my handwriting. Wow, it's still here after 35 years. Now, 1979 was when I left the planetarium. So it's, I don't know, kind of a weird but neat feeling.
John, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
No, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
John Hare, a former Abrams employee, is in town to help reassemble the original star projector at Abrams Planetarium. And here to tell us more now about Abrams' 50th and the operations of Abrams Planetarium in 2014 is John French, Interim Director and Production Coordinator at Abrams Planetarium. Hi, John.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. How many visitors of all, I mean, I think of Abrams as a school kid kind of experience, because like thousands of other mid-Michigan school kids, I remember taking the bus to Abrams Planetarium. It was a great, fun time. How many visitors of all ages do you get into the planetarium?
Right, yeah. You know, I don't have those numbers right in front of me, but I think it's somewhere around 20,000 visitors a year.
Okay.
You know, counting the weekend public shows and the school field trips that we have during the week.
And tell what's your bread and butter? What kind of viewings and events do you do on a regular basis?
Right. Well, our public shows are every week and every Friday and Saturday nights at 8 p.m. and then Sundays at 2:30 and 4 p.m. we have our public shows. And then during the week, we have schools that come in Tuesdays through Fridays. Schools from all over the state come to visit the Abrams Planetarium.
Remind our listeners about the Abrams family here in Lansing, because they were really the catalyst for this.
Right, yeah. Ted Abrams is who the planetarium is named after. I guess Ted and his wife, Leota. And he was an aviation pioneer, and one of the things that he did was kind of was the, I guess, inventor almost of aerial photography. And he even built a special airplane back in the 30s that was designed specifically for aerial photography.
Yeah.
And made his fortune that way.
Any renowned visitors to Abrams Planetarium over the years?
Yeah, well, I'm sure there's been quite a few. I did hear a story that Isaac Asimov, the famous science fiction writer, was here years ago. We had a planetarium show that was based on one of his short stories called The Last Question. And one of the stories I heard was that when he was here back in the 70s, he brought with him a calculator, an HP calculator, and he was really proud of it and made sure that it was put in the safe while he was giving his talk so that it wouldn't be messed with or stolen.
My, or anything. Cutting-edge technology,
calculator.
TI-1200, yes.
Right.
I'm curious, does Abrams Planetarium attract serious students or scholars as well, or can you say you're primarily geared to the non-professional, the non-scholar?
Yeah, I mean, we are part of the astronomy department, and most of what goes on there is just public education and trying to teach people about looking at the night sky and kind of the wonders of the things that you can see up in the night sky. But one of the things that we are moving towards, we've just recently hired a new director that is hoping to try to do some educational research and perhaps study some of the positive effects of field trips on education and kind of work with astronomers and work with the education department to try to do some actual research out of the planetarium.
We just heard John Hare's perspective on reassembling the original star projector. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, well, it was a lot of fun. We pretty much put it together last week, but it's still sitting in one of the assembly bays over in the BPS building. But today we're going to move it out into the lobby. We had to wait till we got a crane and a lift that we could move it over there. And put it up, and it was a lot of fun putting it together, seeing how all that old technology worked with the analog computers. I'd really love to thank Dean Schutz and Dan Edmonds. They really helped put the thing together. It's their space that we were using, and they saw all these pieces that we were putting there and were so fascinated by them that they just kind of jumped in and started to try to reassemble it on their own and really helped us out. And of course, Tom Palazzolo, the head of the machine shop over there, really helped quite a bit too.
We got a brand new month we're looking at here today, and a lot of people who are attracted to the night sky, looking at the night sky, think, well, okay, what's unfolding in April? What is happening in April that's notable?
Yeah, well, the planet Mars is coming up to opposition early in April, and opposition is when the planet is really best viewed. Mars sometimes is pretty far away from us, but when it's near opposition, it's relatively close, and so it's going to be much brighter in our sky than it might normally be. And so Mars right now, if you want to see it, go outside shortly after the sun goes down and look over towards the east, and you will see a bright red star over there, and that is the planet Mars.
Okay. So Mars, anything else?
Well, Jupiter is still in the sky. Jupiter's been in the sky for a while, and it'll remain there for a few more months, and it's kind of high up in the southwest. It's the brightest thing that you'll see up there other than the moon.
Okay. John French is the interim director of Abrams Planetarium. We've been talking about the 50th anniversary of Abrams Planetarium here in East Lansing. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Every year, thousands of people from around the state and elsewhere visit a museum in the Lansing area. The State of Michigan Historical Museum downtown, perhaps, or the dynamic new Broad Art Museum in East Lansing are two that come to mind. Not long ago, Current State learned of a museum tucked away in East Lansing that you may not have heard of. Its collection may not get the attention the Broad does, but it's safe to say it occupies a unique niche here in mid-Michigan. Here to tell us more about this attraction and we use the term loosely, we welcome John French, curator of East Lansing's Moist Towelette Museum. John, it's great to see you.
Thanks, Mark. Glad to be here.
This collection is off the beaten path. Where are you exactly?
Well, we're located in room 100 of the Abrams Planetarium, actually. And it's a small museum, but visitors are welcome to come over and take a look.
A museum comprised of moist towelettes is interesting in a kind of unsettling way. Tell us about your collection.
We have moist towelettes from all over the world. I think almost every continent except for Antarctica has supplied a moist towelette to the museum.
Wow.
And we have them for many different purposes, and I even brought a few samples with me today that we can take a look at if you'd like.
Interesting. Why don't you reach one and just tell us the story?
I mean, we've got quite a few. A lot of them come from airlines. We have one from Aer Lingus, the Irish airline company. We've got one from Air Portugal.
Do most of these come from airlines then?
No. We do have some that have some kind of odd sources, I guess. Let's see. Like, here's one that's called the Sun Hopper. It's a suntan moist towelette that lets you put suntan oil on.
So it contains I see.
Yeah. And now here's one that's kind of interesting. This is a mammo wipe. This one is used before you get a mammogram to cleanse yourself before a mammal wipe.
That's the mammal wipe.
Important.
Okay.
Trump Castle. A lot of casinos have moist towelettes, and so we have quite a few.
Good
idea. There's a whole wing of the museum that's dedicated to
casino
towelettes. Quite a few of those. Now, here's one that I find really fascinating. This is a Polident wipe. It's a moist towelette that's used for cleaning your dentures.
Okay.
And the instructions tell us that you can use it with your dentures in or out.
How? Oh, my goodness. A very versatile towelette.
An important part of the instructions here, it does tell you to discard after use. I think that's really important to let people know about that.
I'm a little queasy asking this next question, but how did this interest in the world of moist towelettes take shape?
I guess everybody has to collect something, and so I started collecting moist towelettes probably back in the early 90s, and a lot of my friends knew that I was collecting moist towelettes and started donating them, and since then I've been getting donations from friends and from strangers. I have information on the Moist Towelettes website that shows how you can donate a moist towelette, and I get moist towelettes sent to me from all over the world.
Are you a germaphobe by any chance?
Probably a little bit, yeah.
I imagine that might not be a good thing, though, because you might be tempted to destroy a piece in the collection.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, I do try to keep most of them still in their original packets, but every once in a while I will open one up just to kind of check to see if the containers really was good. And I actually brought some here that I have multiple copies of, an Action Moist Towelette. If you'd like, we can open one up, and this one's probably from
the 90s. Are you sure you want it? You want to open one of these up?
Well, sure. I've got quite a few of these Action towelettes. It's something I don't do too often, but if you're interested, we can. We can open it up and see how well the packaging has held up since the 90s. People often ask whether they maintain their moisture, and you can see this still has quite a bit of moisture. Take a feel on that, Mark.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. How about that? That's held up really well.
Right. So
rather dramatic moment, opening up one of your artifacts.
Yeah, well, now this is an Action towelette. And
Now what is the – that's just the brand name?
It's just the brand name, Action towelette. I guess perhaps they're used if you're really a very active person, you would use the Action towelette.
In the world of baseball card collecting, the rarest find is always considered the 1909 Honus Wagner card. In the world of moist towelettes, is there an equivalent to that?
I can tell you that the oldest towelette that I have is from the 60s. I have some here in their original box called the Wash-Up Moist Towelettes.
This definitely looks...
Yeah, it's, you can look at the box, and you know, these are all available to see over in the museum. But this one is quite nice. You can see it has a nice package here, and it has a copyright date on it from 1963.
Yeah, I can touch it?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, well, as long as we don't open that one. That one's a pretty old one.
Not accustomed to being able to touch the art in a museum.
Yeah, well, it is an interactive museum, so, you know, if you come and visit the museum, we do let people, you know, look at them and pick them up. We just prefer that they don't open them.
This is this says copyright Lens Clean Incorporated, 1963. And it's New York 1, New York. I mean, it was pre-zip code. So that is quite quite an art. You know, I'm struck by the similarity between your collection of moist towelettes and the world of fine wine collecting. I mean, in both cases, there is something desirable but inaccessible, something hidden to be opened up. But years go by before that happens. Have you ever been struck with that similarity?
Well, I do know that the aroma and the scent is really, really important with the moist towelette. I mean, it's not just the moisture, but, you know, that lemony scent is really and then different towelettes, of course, have, you know, different scents and different, you know, smells that really,
of course, yet
really
another analogy
attract the palate and, yeah. And are really quite nice.
In recent years, I've noticed larger containers of moistened, germ-killing towelettes on store shelves. What do you make of this trend?
Right. Well,
I'm especially curious. I mean, does this cheapen or corrupt the experience of a moist towelette connoisseur like yourself?
Right. Well, personally, I do prefer the individually wrapped moist towelettes as opposed to the type that are in the
understood,
you know, large plastic container. But they do have their place, and I've even seen a recipe where people can make them themselves. There's some online recipes for how to make your own baby wipes or moist towelettes from paper towels, and you add some moisture and glycerin and soap and put it into a Tupperware container, and you can kind of make your own moist towelettes.
Folk art,
yeah,
really.
Exactly,
I mean,
yeah,
if you think about it.
Right, right.
I've wondered whether someone who just stumbled onto your collection might throw it away. I mean, is that a concern?
Yeah, well, you know, hopefully the docents that we have at the museum keep a close watch on the collection and make sure that people don't just walk up and assume that
these are highly trained individuals, I would imagine.
Exactly, yes. It does take some time to really get, you know, fully trained up and, you know, into the docent program that we have there.
Yeah. A lot of times when I visited museums, the one time I visited a museum, I noticed thermometers and hygrometers, devices that monitor humidity to maintain the right humidity to preserve the art. I have to assume that the right humidity in the moist towelette museum is pretty important.
Yeah, that is very critical. It is important to, you know, maintain the moisture. Although you can see that as we opened up the one here, if the packaging is quality packaging, it will maintain its moisture even through adverse conditions.
And once again, remind our listeners where the East Lansing Moist Towelette Museum is.
Yeah, the Moist Towelette Museum can be visited weekdays. When I'm there, and it's in room 100 at the Abrams Planetarium.
Okay. John French is the curator and founder of East Lansing's often overlooked Moist Towelette Museum. John, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll take a closer look at the Kids Count survey and recap General Motors CEO Mary Barra's testimony. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Have a great day.